This is Ecclesiastes chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to them all. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Amen. Please be seated. Happy Father's Day and happy first day of summer 2021. It's here. It's amazing. That might be the last happy note you're going to hear all morning here in Ecclesiastes. Maybe. You have to wait to find out if there's any happiness here, but there's certainly not happiness on the surface here. We talked a couple of weeks ago when we opened this new series through the book of Ecclesiastes that this is a book that is severely underread and underused, and it is a great problem for the church that we don't better know the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, because this is a book that explores life under the sun. That's a phrase that's used all throughout the book. Life under the sun, which is life in the here and now. Life as we know it, with all of its absurdities and all of its enigmas. That's life under the sun. And Solomon is exploring life under the sun. And it's grievous. It's grievous. Vanity. Struggle. Toil. Is he hopeless? We said no, Solomon is not hopeless, but he is being very honest. We have here not a hopeless man, but an honest man. A man who has a God big enough who can handle his honesty. It should make us think, do we have the kind of relationship with God where we can say honestly what Solomon said here? I hated life. He's being honest because he's a man who himself is experiencing life under the sun. He's not just watching other people experience the absurdities. He himself is experiencing the absurdities. He's not hopeless, but he's honest. He's not saying that all of life is meaningless, but he is saying that everything we give ourselves to is momentary. And therefore, it can feel meaningless, like there's nothing that endures, there's nothing that's lasting, no lasting significance or dignity for men and women in this world. So he's not saying everything is meaningless, but it is momentary. He is not being a pessimist, but he is offering perspective. Perspective from the eyes of one who is a believer. This king of Israel, guardian of the promises of the God who made us, our covenant Lord. He's coming from the perspective of one who knows these promises, who has believed these promises, and yet he is not free from the struggles of life under the sun. There is no vaccine, even for the believer, he's saying, for life under the sun. We experience this also. And so he's wrestling with this. He's exploring this. What do we do with our lives? Is there some pathway we can walk where we can figure out how to do life under the sun better than we currently are? Is there some way we can find enduring significance and meaning rather than this toiling and chasing after the wind? He's exploring this. And we should be glad that he is. This is a very important question. The reason life under the sun is the way that it is because, as the Bible says, God himself who made this world has placed a curse upon this world. In Genesis chapter 3, when the first man and woman believed the lie, when they sinned, rebelled against the Lord, sought to live their own way, to experience life under their sun, according to what it would be like if they could be a little bit more like God. And life under the sun radically changed. A curse was placed upon the physical creation and everyone who has ever been created. About 500 years ago, life under the sun was described in this way that I find very helpful from the Westminster Larger Catechism. This is question and answer number 28. This is a precious confession that we hold to here at New City. And the question it poses here is, what are the punishments of sin in this world? That's a simple enough question. In other words, what is the problem with life under the sun? What are the curses that have come upon us? And here's the answer. The curse of sin in this world are either inward, for example, blindness of mind, a depraved sense, strong delusions, hardness of heart, horror of conscience, and vile affections. Those are the inward struggles we have because of the curse under the sun. Also, they are outward. For example, the curse of God upon the creatures in creation. That is, the volcanoes that explode and kill people. The snakes that bite and inject poison into vulnerable children. The curse of God upon the creatures of this world. And all other evils that befall us in our bodies, in our names, in our estates, relations, and employments, together with death itself. That's the answer it gives. Listen to that again. All other evils that befall us in our bodies, that is the sickness that comes upon us, the brokenness and pain that we feel in our bodies and in our minds. It says the evil that befalls our names, that is your reputation and your name that can be so twisted and maligned, not even remembered or perhaps unappreciated or wrongly appreciated. Your estate and all the things that can befall your possessions and all that you have labored for your estate isn't safe in this world. All of your relations, it says, a curse has been placed upon. That's why friendships are so hard and relationships are so hard and family life and marriage and all of those things. Well, we do that under the sun where a curse has fallen upon this. And all of our employments, the toils and the work, whether in our vocational employment or all the ways that we serve and work and use our energy and our time, together with death itself. That's why C.S. Lewis, the 20th century poet, author, philosopher. That's why he says, perennial and abiding dissatisfaction stalks not just the rebel, but even the faithful saint at their best. The settled happiness and security which we all desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. He says, we are never safe. We are never safe. We are never safe. And it's not hard to see why, he writes. For the security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world. And it opposes our return to God when we find rest in this world. A few moments of happy love, a landscape, a bathe, a symphony, a merry meeting with our friends, a football match, they have no such tendency to lead us back to rest our hearts in God. Our Father refreshes us along the journey of this life with some pleasant stays at a hotel or with some pleasant stays at an inn, but will not encourage us to mistake these hotels for our true home. You will not find your true home in life under the sun, but Solomon is exploring every angle to see some way that we might be able to. That's why in chapter 1, we saw a couple of weeks ago in verse 8, it says, Solomon says, I don't even have words to describe this. I'm speechless at what it's like to live life under the sun. No eye is satisfied. No ear is filled, he says in verse 8 of chapter 1. What he's saying is, everything in us fights against the limitations that have been placed upon us. Everything in us is searching for some way to do a happy and safe and good and enduring life under the sun. Our eyes are looking. Our ears are listening. We're looking for a man who will come and bring some peace to our lives. We're looking for a woman who will come and bring some sense of intimacy. We're looking for that intimate embrace. We're looking for that tender kiss. We're looking to that one place that we can go that would solve the problems of our life under the sun. For that one job that would allow us to fulfill our potential as a man or a woman. We're looking, our eyes are searching, but they're not satisfied. Our ears are listening for some promise from some person or some place or some politician. We're looking. But he says, no eye is satisfied, no ear is filled, even though we search everywhere. And the reason why is because the curse of God upon life under the sun fights against us at every turn. But we keep fighting. And Solomon is fighting here from one perspective. He's saying, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. That's what he means in the words we just read when he says, basically, if I, the king, can't figure this out, then what about the person who comes after me? In other words, I have all the resources and wisdom to get to the bottom of this thing. I'm going to figure out a way, if there is a way, to do life under the sun that's more enduring in its significance, in its happiness, in its safety. I'm going to figure this out, he says. Well, last week, Pastor Matt did a wonderful job of looking at Solomon's approach through pleasure. Solomon's first attempt was to figure out if there was a way that pleasure, the little paradises that we create in this world, the parks and the pleasures, and I can't remember all the P's, but they were wonderful. What were those P's, Matt? Parks? Passions? Possessions? And profits! Yeah! Solomon says, nope, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's chasing after the wind. It's vaporous. That's the word that he's using here for vanity. When he says all is vanity, he's saying it's vaporous. You try to grab hold of it. You work hard to grab hold of it. You work hard to keep it. And it was so fun chasing it because you just knew it would answer your problems. But you look and it's not there. That doesn't work. And so he turns, as we'll see this morning, to wisdom and to our work. Is there some insight through wisdom and or folly that will answer the question we have about how to do life under the sun? Or is there some way that we can work hard enough or that we can work smart enough to do life under the sun in a better way. That's what he's looking at this morning, wisdom and work. Let's look first at what he says about wisdom. Notice he says, I'm looking at wisdom and folly. In other words, he's looking at both sides of the coin of wisdom. Maybe there is something to the other side of the coin of wisdom. Maybe we're missing something when it comes to folly. Is there an avenue through folly that would open the way to a better, more enduring, safer, happier, better life under the sun? Or is it through wisdom? You see, when Solomon, who also is the writer of Proverbs, when he talks about wisdom, what he's talking about is a life that is given to cultivating that which is good and that which is true and that which is righteous, that which is beautiful. That's wisdom. Wisdom. It's when you cultivate and work toward and appreciate that which is good, true, righteous, and beautiful. And so what is folly? Folly is the other side of that coin. Folly is when we begin to appreciate and cultivate that which is not true or beautiful or righteous or good, but that which is obscene and that which is absurd, that which is confusing, that which is dark. That's what folly is. It's when not beauty is cultivated, but ugliness is cultivated. Not when righteousness, but unrighteousness. And so he's looking at wisdom, and he's looking at folly. Is there something we're missing here? And he's looking at where he can find wisdom in this world and examples of that, and what are examples also of folly. Might this provide insight for us in order to do life under the sun? Is there something we can find there that would release us from the curse? That would release us from the pain and the unsafety and the unhappiness? Is there something we can find in either wisdom or folly? Some way of release. And he had the ability to search the world to find answers. This morning we don't need to search the world. We can look all around us. We can find many examples of wisdom and of folly in the world in which we live. And it's important for us to look at these things from both angles. Let's take, for example, this school right down the street. There's a wonderful little school right down the street. And every day of the week, I observe wisdom when I drive by this school. Because when I come, I see signs all over the place recognizing the vulnerability of these little children. Signs that say, slow down. I see more police cars around watching for people driving fast because of these vulnerable little pedestrians. There are limitations placed upon automobiles. There are limitations placed upon cyclists for the sake of these vulnerable little pedestrians. Do you know what that is? In God's common grace, we see wisdom. Recognizing that here are these precious little children and there must be order and there must be protection. There are fences. There are special lines they stand in, a line that runs around the corner, and parents have a special way that they need to drop off to make sure no one who shouldn't be there is there. It's very wise, actually. It's a great example of how we see that in our culture. It's cultivating that which is good and beautiful and protective. It's helpful for human life. And yet, when we look at the other side of the coin, do we also see folly? Yes, we also see folly. You see, in that same school, more and more parents are being taught and trained to teach their children, essentially, intentionally, to not be sure about the most basic identity of our creatureliness and one of the greatest privileges we have in this world, to be a man or a woman, to be a male or female. Now, I realize the church isn't supposed to talk about this, and I want you to know that from the beginning of New City, we talk about everything under the sun, especially things that other people are talking about, especially when people come to me and they're confused about how to think about something or what to do about something. And so this issue of gender confusion is a very important conversation. Why in the world wouldn't we talk about this in the church, especially when we're studying someone who's exploring the depths of wisdom and folly under the sun? Might the people who cultivate those things on the folly side have something? Might they have some insights into life under the sun? And I do say folly, and I mean that, and I want to be very honest about the fact that I do put that in the folly category. As if children in elementary school aren't confused enough. When a pimple shows up on their face, they're distraught. When they begin to realize that other people wear nicer clothes than they do, when they begin to realize they're either faster or slower or bigger or smaller, I don't know if you remember, but it's very confusing to figure out who we are, let alone when the authorities in your life begin questioning you. Are you really certain about whether you're a boy or a girl? When parents are being told to hold off on declaring what your external biology says, to throw off common sense, to throw off common science, to throw off common biblical spirituality. It is an aggressive form of, and I'll use the word abuse, in the lives of our children. It is folly. And don't be confused about it. I've heard from people recently who have said, I'm the last person in my office that doesn't have my pronouns on my email signature. Should I do it? People taking their children to the doctors now and all the paperwork and children being asked personally, are they sure of their gender identity? It is folly. And it's an attempt to throw off the futility of life under the sun. It is cultivating that which is absurd, that which is obscene, that which is not good, true, or beautiful, in order to find some enduring significance, because other things aren't working. And that's why there's folly in this world, because people keep trying. I do want to say this. In addition, I realize that being up front here, this being a sermon and a monologue, we're not having a dialogue right now. We do want to dialogue about this. Me talking about this being folly does not mean that people who might be confused in that area or who might think differently aren't welcome here. In fact, just the opposite. Because this is a place filled with people who have given their lives over to many forms of folly. New City is not a place where you'll find people who have not indulged in folly. We have, but we've recognized it. We continue to recognize it and admit it and recognize our need for the gracious mercy of a loving God. And we would love to talk with you. We would love for you to come to us in honesty to say, I don't believe the way you believe. I'm confused about that. But I'm telling you, this issue of gender is one of the big and confusing issues that are affecting many lives of the most vulnerable around us. And we want you to come, and I want to make it very clear, you will never be met with condemnation. You will never be met with condemnation if you come to us with different views or even lifestyles. You'll never be met with condemnation. You will also not be met with a celebration of things that the Bible calls folly. What you will be met with is compassion and conversation about a God who saves broken people and who teaches us from His Word true wisdom and what is good and true and beautiful. And we're all growing in that here at New City. You won't be met with condemnation. You also won't be met with a celebration of things that the Bible calls folly, but you will be met with the compassion in conversation about the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, wisdom and folly, Solomon actually finds a happy insight here as he's looking at this. Aha, he says. The wind keeps blowing my Bible page here. Life under the sun. Look, Solomon says, aha! Wisdom is better than folly. Verse 13. I saw it. There is more gain in wisdom than in folly. Aha! That's good news. In fact, it's not even a close race. It's like light and darkness. People who walk in wisdom are like people who walk with eyes in their head. In other words, their eyes work and they can see. People who walk in folly are like those stumbling through the darkness. The light is better than the darkness. Wisdom is better than folly. That's great. So it is good to live in wisdom rather than folly. However, it doesn't answer his ultimate question. Because even this fails. It doesn't release us ultimately. There is no insight, there is no wisdom that ultimately will release you from life under the sun. Even though wisdom is better, notice what he says in verses 15 through 17. He says, I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why have I been so very wise? I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. Oh, how the wise dies just like the fool. In other words, even if you've given your life in self-denial, in working hard, doing things that were wise, even though you were made fun of, or it cost you financially, or in some way, you've given your life to wisdom. Guess what? You end up just like the fool. Death levels the playing field. Death has the last word over the wise person and over the fool. And this is the point at which Solomon says, oh, I hated life when this thought came to mind. I hated life. This doesn't make any sense. They end up the same way. Living in wisdom doesn't give anyone advantage over the reality of death that hangs over us. And that's just terrible, Solomon says. I hated it. I hated it. I hated it. But maybe I'm onto something here, even though the answer is not in wisdom, maybe it is in work. Notice he says, I worked really hard. I toiled in all of these labors. The answer is not in wisdom, but maybe the answer is in the way that I can work. Maybe harder, or maybe smarter. Maybe through our work we can produce something that would give us an answer for the difficulties of life under the sun. And so he turns his attention to work. But alas, again, he realizes the answer is not found in work. Look at verses 20 through 23. So I turned about after he realizes this, and he says, I gave my heart up to despair all over over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill, you've used all that you know, you've used all that you're good at, you've given the physical energy to it, you've labored toward it, you've used all of your skill, and all that it produced, you must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. And that person may be wise, it may be a fool, but sometime soon it will fall into the hands of a fool who will foolishly mismanage what you did. At best, you will be forgotten or unappreciated. Solomon says, I hated this. It's vanity. It's a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? Is that not an important question? Think about your past couple of weeks. What have you given yourself to? What have you worked for in your family and in your home and in your relationships and in your place of work and what you do after work? What have you given your time and energy to, your emotional resources? He says that too. Notice he says, all our days are, there's a toil in verse 22, a striving of heart. That means our heart's in it. We get emotional about our work. And we give our heart to it. And yet, what happens? Our days are full of sorrow. Our work is a vexation. And even at night, our heart does not rest. We stay up at night worrying about those things. And everything you gave yourself to will be mismanaged when you're gone, forgotten, and you will be underappreciated. Now, how's that for a happy Father's Day and a happy first day of summer? You will be forgotten, underappreciated, and what you've worked for will be mismanaged. Solomon says, I hate this. It's terrible. It's terrible. You see, the problem is not with wisdom or work in and of itself. Wisdom and work is good. That was part of paradise. That is to be part of paradise. Work was something that was a real privilege given to human beings before even sin entered this world. Working, not competing with someone else. Working without loss or without theft. Working without pain. Working in a way that you use your skills and gifts in a way that brings you so much pleasure and God so much glory. And it is a joy for you to be busy with the business of life under the sun. Work in and of itself is good. Wisdom in and of itself is good. However, with life under the sun, work is turned into something that feels like thorns being driven through your fingers. The sweat coming from your brow and you can't stop it from dripping. It's painful. And generation after generation, we fight against it because generation after generation, we hate the way in which our work has been cursed, but we have to keep working. We have to keep producing. If we want to eat, if we want to live, we spend so much of our life wondering, can I ever get a job or work in a way that will produce me to live the life I want to live? And then when you get enough work, you say, I have so much work, I can't even live. And so people fight and they try different avenues to deal with this problem under the sun, with this vanity, with this chasing after the wind. I mean, think, for example, again, let's just look right here in our own little neighborhood. Look at the beautiful building behind me. One of our construction guys last week, a member of our church, told me that each one of those pieces of tile were hand chiseled. I just thought they were old and broken. But when they put those on new, they were hand chiseled. I won't tell you how much that roof is worth. It's a 100-year slate roof. It's beautiful. Look at the architecture. You know there were architects who traveled here, who were up at night wrestling with a way to produce a beautiful building. They labored, they sweat, there were arguments, there was pain, but they did it and they produced it. Do you know what their names are? Nope. None of us do. No one thinks about them or appreciates them. In fact, not many years later, this all was about to be torn down and made into office space and condos. That's what that hard work was going to. Think about this side of the building. The people who worshipped in there, that was the first sanctuary of this church. Not many years later, the people who built this side and began worshipping over here, over time began believing something very differently than those people believed. Just a short generation after. And they worked really hard. They labored and they prayed and they gave and they were here serving. And what Solomon's saying is, for what? All that they did was mismanaged, forgotten, underappreciated. It's vanity. Speaking of buildings, my favorite building in the entire Detroit area is the Postville Courthouse. Do any of you know where the Postville Courthouse is? Anybody? At Greenfield Village! And the reason I love the Postville Courthouse is because I grew up walking distance from the Postville Courthouse. I grew up in Lincoln, Illinois, which was the first town named Lincoln before he was president. And one of the pieces of pride of our town was the Postville Courthouse, where Abraham Lincoln practiced law. It was great. And to my surprise, when I went to Greenfield Village for the first time, I saw the Postville Courthouse. And I thought, how amazing. People worked hard enough to replicate the Postville Courthouse. Until I found out that they had traveled down Henry Ford, and they had dug up all the acreage around the Postville Courthouse, including the Postville Courthouse, and all the plaster that fell off, and they brought all of that up here, and I grew up with a fake and never knew it. And yet I'm the only person in Detroit region, apparently, who cares about the Postville Courthouse. And all that work that Henry Ford put in the resources. The only people that care about it are me and that nerdy historian who dresses up and gives you a tour. If the ministry doesn't work out, that's what I want to do. You can find me dressed up working at the Postville Courthouse. That's what I'll do, but it's underappreciated, it's forgotten. Speaking of the Postville Courthouse. Speaking of the Postville Courthouse, Abraham Lincoln. Whatever you might think of Abraham Lincoln, know this. Few people have ever worked harder and smarter in the history of leadership in this world. He was an amazing politician. He was a tireless worker, and many would call him amazingly wise, even if they didn't agree with his politics. That's one of the things that made him so great, is he had a team of people who did not see things his way, and yet he brought them all together toward great accomplishments. No one worked harder. If anyone should have been enduring, if anyone should have felt the enduring significance and dignity of life, it was Lincoln. No one worked harder. No one worked smarter. And yet, his last speech, a speech promoting the voting rights of black men and women. There was a man in the crowd, a famous Hollywood so-and-so before there was Hollywood. John Wilkes Booth. John Wilkes Booth hated Abraham Lincoln's promotion of abolishing slavery and certainly of voting rights. And it's too nasty to tell you what he said in a letter to his mother. But one of the things he said is this. This is Abraham Lincoln's last speech ever. And when Lincoln was depressed, he would go to the play. And he went to the play depressed to find some comfort. And John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, I just realized this week, I was looking up the dates for Juneteenth and trying to figure out the significance of this new holiday, and come to find out, it was because it was on the last date, June 19th, 1865, when the last state declared slavery to be illegal. And immediately I realized that was the year Abraham Lincoln died. And I was so curious, did he ever see that day? And it was 2 months prior to that declaration in Texas that Abraham Lincoln was killed in the playhouse. Solomon says, toil. You don't experience the fruits of your labor. It's forgotten. It's not appreciated. It will be mismanaged. Some people say, because of this, I will avoid work. I will avoid work. I'll find a way to do that. And we have people that learn to live in other people's homes for their entire lives or off of other people's resources, and they spend their whole lives trying not to enter into the thorns of hard work. And it doesn't work, because when a human being tries not to work, a human being is disintegrated, because we were made in God's image to work. And so not working in order to avoid the curse only brings the curse upon you in a deeper way, in which you live with a sense that you are not what you were made to be. You live with a sense of guilt and of shame. And as one who was made to produce good and beautiful things for your Creator, and yet you've bowed out and it doesn't work. Other people Other people try to outwork the fall and the curse of sin. They try to outwork, overwork, thinking overwork will solve my problems. This was a growing issue in Solomon's day, so he's giving perspective here to his own culture, because in his culture now there were more open markets and there was more international trade and there was more riches to be had between Israel and the surrounding nations. And so you could get rich quick, especially if you worked hard and especially if you worked smart. And guess what? People bit into that. And guess what? People made idols out of riches and money. And they spent their lives and their years working, saying, I'm going to get enough now so that later I'll be able to enjoy life. That will fix the problem under the sun. But Solomon says it's absolutely chasing after the wind. It doesn't work. Overwork doesn't work for life under the sun. And that speaks to us in the 21st century America as well, because we too make a god out of the dollar. We know what it is to bow down to riches and the hard work that it takes to get there in order to find something that will release us from the struggle of life under the sun. Another dollar, a little bit more hard work at the expense of life. And Solomon says it's chasing after the wind. It doesn't work. Maybe we can outsmart it. Maybe there's some system that we can give ourselves to that will work. I mean, this is what was underneath Karl Marx's vision for a socialist society. It was his frustration with life under the sun. He recognized the same problem that Solomon found. The problem is, in his attempt to fix this, he recreated a vision of history in which history moves from the lower to the upper. That is, from slavery to feudalism into capitalism, which is an evil, and then into socialism and communism, when there will be no more need for revolution, no more need for conflict, because that is the place where everything will be right. There will be an equilibrium. There will be no classes, no wars. Everything will be right. It was his vision of paradise. The only problem is it rejected the God of the Bible. It rejected any notion of any God. The God is nature. And people who are a reflection of nature coming together. And the greatest problem, he says, is an alienation from the fruit of our labor. And that's the problem that needs to be fixed. That's why we're not happy. That's why revolution is needed. Because we work, but we don't see the benefits of it. And that will be fixed. And that's his attempt to overcome the futility of life under the sun. And we need to look only to the Soviet Union and Germany and Cambodia and other places to see that that did not fix the problems of life under the sun. And so Solomon moves again to some sense of hope as he gives perspective to God's people. Notice the perspective that he gives in verse 24. He turns to a bit of sunshine and hope here. After all this futility, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat or drink and find enjoyment in his toil. That seems to contradict what he just said, because he talked about the vanity of toil and all the pleasures of life. But now he's saying find enjoyment in these things. And what he's doing here is he's giving wonderful perspective. In verse 24, to those who believe the promises of the God of the Bible, he says, we recognize that we do not find life in food and pleasure and in our toil. That's when it will kill you and leave you left to dry and empty. But what we recognize is that these are good gifts. There are ordinary gifts that our Creator has given as a gift that we can enjoy. And so he's saying here that ordinary things like food and drink and a meal or a cup of ice cream together with friends, that's a gift. And you can praise God for this good gift because He gave it to you. In fact, that was part of Eden, eating and drinking and relationships and work. We have the stuff of Eden here, and he's saying, view it as a good gift from God. More people should sit down with their family and have a nice meal and laugh together. And perhaps enjoy a tasty drink or cup of ice cream with your spouse and laugh some more. And then go to work and recognize that work is not your life, but it is good and it's an opportunity for you to use your skill in ways that bring good in this world. And he's saying you can enjoy that. You can look at this as a gift. However, even that does not fix the problem. That does not become your salvation. Verse 26, he's saying God has a grand plan. Apart from him, apart from God, who can eat or who can have any enjoyment? For to the one who pleases God, God gives wisdom and knowledge. But to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting. Only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. This is language he's using for believers and non-believers. In the Bible, when it talks about those who please God versus those who don't please God, this is covenantal language. And what he's saying here is that God has a grand plan and grand wisdom and work that will release us. He says, there will be a day when all the believers will receive everything that the unbelievers produce. In other words, as we've heard before from Jesus, the meek will inherit the earth, is what he's saying. And then Jesus comes along, and Jesus, think about how Jesus followed up on this language from Ecclesiastes. Jesus said, when you pray, pray for what? Your daily bread. It's a good thing. It's a gift to enjoy. But also, he ends that prayer with a seeking after God's kingdom, which lasts forever. Jesus said, don't worry about what you're going to eat or wear or drink. Your heavenly Father knows you need these things. They're good gifts. Enjoy them. But seek first his kingdom. He's saying, in the here and now, there are gifts to enjoy, and you should. And you should give praise to your Creator for those good gifts. However, there is an eternity. It goes beyond this life under the sun, and God is the only one who has the answer to this. And the answer is in Jesus. That's why Jesus, in John chapter 11, he experienced life under the sun when he lost his friend Lazarus. And Jesus and his friends were sad. And even his friend said, Jesus, why couldn't you have done more to fix this problem under the sun? Our friend died. Jesus didn't even go see his friend until after 4 days, which was known to be the state at which a person was being corrupted. Which adds significance, to the third day in which Jesus rose. He waited the fourth day and he went, and we're told Jesus was angry. What he saw, he was moved with anger because he saw life under the sun. And he said to his friends who were hurting, he'll rise again. And they said, oh yeah, we know. Like, we know that old teaching about this general resurrection. And Jesus, noticing their boredom, their theological boredom with news of a resurrection, Jesus said, oh, wait, I don't think you get what I'm saying when I'm talking to you about this good news of resurrection. And Jesus called in to the tomb, Lazarus, get up. And we're told Lazarus was released. He was released from the curse of death, and he was raised. And Jesus was simply saying, don't be bored when I talk about resurrection. Don't be bored when I talk about gospel. I am the resurrection. Lazarus is going to go back to the tomb at some point, but what you're going to see in me is someone who will go to the depths of the curse. I will take the thorns for you. I will take the curse of sin for you. And all who believe and who receive me, I did it in their place, and I will overcome the curse of life under the sun, and I will be raised to a new life, and everyone who receives me by faith will experience the only way to be released from life under the sun. I am the resurrection, Jesus says. I am the new life. And so Ephesians 2 says, it is by grace you have been saved by faith. This is not of yourselves. It is not by works, affirming what Solomon says. It is not by works so that you cannot boast. Let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, Jeremiah says, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me, says the Lord, that I am the Lord who exercises mercy and kindness and justice on earth. And so at the end of the day, what do we do with Ecclesiastes 2? We boast. Not in our work and not in our wisdom, because they don't hold the key. But we boast in God's work in and through Jesus Christ. And His wisdom seen in His grand scheme to bring us to new life through Christ. And so, New City, in our life under the sun, we are not hopeless, but we can be honest. Life is not meaningless, but there is a momentariness to it. And we shall not be pessimists, New City, but we do have the perspective of the gospel, which allows us to give thanks to our Creator for the good gifts we have here and now, but also recognizing those good gifts are not our salvation. But the gift of Jesus Christ is our salvation, and we boast in His wisdom and His work. And we can rejoice in life under the sun, knowing that our God has a grand scheme to lift us out of life under the sun through His Son, through His wisdom and His work. Amen.